The next case is 11-464, Disciplinary Counsel versus William Lawrence Summers. Mr. Close.
Chief Justice, Justices, Mr. Caligaria, it is my honor to represent Bill Summers, and I am here to say to begin with categorically that no sanctional violation of our code occurred in this case. What did happen was this. As the record reflects, Bill was admitted both in Ohio and in Kentucky as a lawyer. As it relates to this case in Rules 1.15 and 1.16 in particular, the distinguishing difference which was admitted into the record was that in Kentucky, non-refundable fees are perfectly permissible. Of course, in Ohio, they're not. The uncontroverted testimony in this case is that Bill Summers inadvertently took out his Kentucky template, modified it to meet this particular client's needs, and gave it to the client. It did not include the language that he was entitled to a refund. So in that regard, there was, in fact, a technical violation. But the testimony at trial established that at least two occasions there were discussion of this fee, and Bill explained the fee. And after the representation was over, he was asked to give an accounting for the money, which we would normally expect him to do under Rule 1.16 anyway, with the appropriate language in there. And he gave that accounting. The violation for not having that language in the agreement is a technical violation, I will concede. But in fact, when all the actions of that lawyer were consistent with that language not being in there, and were consistent with his recognition that, as you have said, the client may be entitled to a refund, there certainly should be no penalty attached to that violation. Obviously, we wouldn't even be here on that probably were it not for the other violation, which is the allegation that there was a clearly excessive fee. I'm not going to repeat everything that's in the record. What is significant that the testimony that the panel took showed that, number one, there was a multi-page discovery document filed with various motions and bill of particulars and so forth, that there were at least five pretrials attended by Bill Summers. More importantly, there was a tape of the incident in question, and I would remind this panel that what this young boy was charged with was a non-probationable offense. If he's convicted of the felony of which he's been indicted, he is going to prison. There was a tape of this altercation up at Cleveland Stadium. Matter of fact, there were several tapes. When the first copies were provided, although the defense attempted to have them enhanced, they were not. Ultimately, Summers files a motion. He wants to see the original tapes from the Cleveland Indians. Cleveland refuses to comply. He ultimately, in addition to all the other stuff he'd done, ends up back in front of Judge Terry in Cuyahoga County on a contempt because Cleveland Indians will not comply with his request to see the tape. Ultimately, the Cleveland Indians consent. An expert and Mr. Summers' associate went out to the stadium, took a look at the tapes, and found that the tapes were of absolutely no evidentiary value. They certainly established that this boy was at the scene of the altercation where the officer had his gun belt ripped off, but they certainly didn't provide anything as far as what the extent or lack thereof of the involvement. And therein lies the problem that gave the real issue to why we're here today. Anthony Bell's mother and father were meddlers in the defense of this case. Bill Summers represented Anthony. He did not represent Dwayne. He did not represent Mrs. Bell. Although continually these parents continued to be involved in the case because they believed their son absolutely that he had no involvement of this incident at all.
Isn't it also the fact that Mr. Bell Sr. borrowed this money from his employer?
Well, that's true. But, Your Honor, the ethical code still requires that you represent the client you're retained to represent.
No, what I'm saying is it's understandable that Mr. Bell and Mrs. Bell were interested in that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I am not critical of that at all. My goodness, I'm a father. What am I going to do? My kids are a lot older than Anthony Bell was, but I certainly would be involved in the event they were charged. But the point is they interfered with the representation, doing things like is in a record where The father says, call me because my son's cell phone is out of order. Well, Bill calls the son, and the son answers the phone. There's nothing wrong with his phone at all. The problem became when the parents meddled in the representation to the point that it became difficult for Bill to complete that representation. At any rate, what this all goes to is the issue of what we have here is a contract that essentially called, the first one was about $2,500 and the second, $15,000 flat fee for the representation. When Summers withdrew, there is no question that he provided an itemized bill that more than supported the retention of that fee. And I would remind the court that 1.16E, I believe, allows that that can happen, as long as we do the appropriate analysis of 1.15 of the code, which was done. Summers provides the itemization, and within 30 days, the Bells file a complaint with the disciplinary council. I'm not being critical at this point, but what happens then is the disciplinary council says, get back half the money, and basically this thing will go away. Summers instead said, let's have a fee arbitration. So we end up with a disciplinary panel hearing a case that from the beginning should have been a fee arbitration.
So this is a fee dispute that's turned into a disciplinary case.
I'm sorry, sir?
This is a fee dispute that's turned into a disciplinary case.
Justice, there is absolutely no question that that's what happened.
What about the representation that the lawyer would represent the client through the completion of the case?
There is no question that the fee contract provided that. But if you'll remember, Your Honor, too, again, if you look at 1.16E, what happens if that termination ends early? You do an itemization. If the client doesn't like the itemization, submit it to arbitration. But it doesn't make it an ethical violation, and particularly given the number of hearings that were attended, the scope of the discovery requested, and the other ancillary motions, and the difficulty with getting the tape from the Cleveland Indians, Bill Summers did something that merited payment.
And what does your research show with respect to what constitutes a clearly excessive fee?
I think the cases are all over the park. If we look at the stuff in Ohio, you know, we've got cases where $5,000 was the fee prior to trial and $10,000 if it went to trial. The second $5,000 was charged. Because it didn't go to trial, you ordered the money returned. That's fair. But by the same token, in this case here, Justice, if Bill would have submitted to an arbitration, offered to submit to an arbitration, and would have refunded whatever any impartial arbitrator said he had to refund. He complied with the rule in every regard by going through the analysis 1.15 and 1.16 require, and then only to have a complaint as of an ethical violation filed against
him. Counsel, do you think that the decision to treat this as an ethical violation as opposed to a fee dispute might have been triggered by the fact that he used the non-refundable form? You know, so there's a distinction of why this isn't a simple fee agreement. It's because on the surface, looking at the document, he's violated the code of conduct, and tagged onto that is a claim of excessive fees. And given that's why we don't have non-refundable fees, to guard against excessive fees. So it's not.
Your Honor, I fully agree. By the way, I apologize, but I didn't ask. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes if I'm not stopped at this point. You're absolutely correct. When they see it come in and they see the non-refundable nature of it, but if it were not for the excessive fee, John Coughlin has run a good office up there in looking at these things reasonably. And when he sees, yes, that language is there and shouldn't be there, but that in fact Summers complied in every regard as if that language weren't there, then I don't think there's ever going to be a complaint filed. You know, to be totally honest about this thing too, Your Honor, not only did that bring it to their attention, but there is no question that Bill Summers, the fine lawyer that he is assertive, he's aggressive, he's argumentative. And that, if you read the transcript of the proceedings in front of the panel, I'm sure that caused his problem. But you got to keep in perspective, for 41 years, he has been one of the preeminent criminal defense lawyers in this country, and of course in Cleveland. He has made his living and his reputation representing those that are underrepresented, doing pro bono work.
So, counsel, are you making an argument to us that this should be dismissed, or that there should be an alternative to the 6 months out, which would be, I'm presuming, a public reprimand or a stay of the suspension?
Of course, Your Honor, the answer is both. I certainly feel that under the excessive
Well-spoken, Mr. Clemens.
That under the excessive fee, there's no violation here. As a matter of fact, we got two experts testifying to the reasonableness of the fee, and the disciplinary council has none. How do you get to clearly excessive fee? I don't know. But in the event on the using the wrong form, you determine that Mr. Summers should be disciplined, or if you disagree with money, the excessive fee, then I think in two regards, the penalty is inappropriate. One is a refunding of the entire $15,000 simply makes no sense given the amount of work was done.
Counsel, how much does Mr. Summers charge per hour? I mean, the question to me, it seemed more than a fee dispute when you've got the panel saying that, you know, in summary, they found little benefit to the client with regard to the work, and then the idea of the itemized bill being padded to justify keeping the entire amount. So there seems to be
Justice,
an issue
let
of
me
deception.
Answer that in two regards, I guess. In the first place, what if he tries the case through trial and the kid goes to prison? What benefit was the representation? You can't look just at the result to determine whether or not there was benefit.
And he did agree to go to trial for that amount of money, which wasn't
now,
done
as
here.
Far as the actual charge, what ended up happening, the evidence would show that when he printed out the time at the end of the bill, and it went back to default rates instead of the other rate that he had charged, his actual billing rate was $400 an hour. And he had discounted that at the portion of time that he was doing on an hourly basis. The point is, and I think what's germane here.
Excuse me, he discounted it for the first couple $1,000s, but not for the $15,000.
In the initial contract, which he did in writing, as he should have done, as your rules recommend, the initial contract called for $250 per hour.
Right.
Plus expenses.
But he bumped it up to $450 when he's itemizing it for the $15,000.
Again, what happened at the end when he's justifying the time, it hit a default rate instead of putting in that $250 an hour rate. It doesn't make any difference in the context
Sounds
of
Sounds like he needs to get a new system.
He's 41 years old, Your Honor. He's kind of like me. It's hard to make some changes.
Well, yeah, you know, Honor, he used the wrong form for the fee agreement. He uses Kentucky form. He uses the wrong form and the wrong amount for computing the justification when called to do so on the $15,000. It seems that he may need to change the system.
Since I've learned long ago in here that I can't ask questions, I would merely ask rhetorically, is using the wrong form in the regards that the court has just suggested an ethical violation? And I think not. I think it certainly can be a mistake. But, you know, particularly when you
counsel, let's get down to the bottom line here. I think that's where everybody's trying to take you. What amount of fee do you believe now he actually earned on an hourly basis?
If $15,000 or the $17,500 actually was a fair fee prospectively, then I think probably him keeping 12.5 or so would be justifiable, because I know now in retrospect what the attorney that replaced him did to ultimately get the case resolved.
Okay, but...
And proportionally, Bill Summers did much more of the work than the other attorney.
But an hourly time of the appropriate hourly rate times the hours spent comes out where?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm drawing a complete blank.
Well, the panel,
but it didn't
the panel says let's wait on fee arbitration, if I read this correctly, and then the board says give back the whole $15,000.
The panel said we're not making a recommendation. The full board made the recommendation of
$15,000. And the panel saw the evidence.
Right.
And the board would have.
And we've concurred since the beginning. We'll do fee arbitration.
Okay.
The other thing I'd like to just insert, and I know that I'm running perilously close to being out of time, when one looks at the history of what this man has done for the legal profession and the underserved, disregarding the amount of reimbursement that's been requested, a suspension of 6 months is just simply excessive. I'd reserve the balance of my time, which is about up.
Nothing. Mr. Caligieri?
Counsel, before you get started, I'm having a little trouble with the logistics here in my mind because I submitted to practice in Kentucky and we had a Kentucky form. I'm thinking he lives in Kentucky, but I'm gathering from all of this that everything is really sort of cited in the Cleveland area.
So. Yes, the entire incident in this case took place in Cleveland, Ohio. The victim, or the client, Tony Bell, was a 19-year-old boy from Buffalo, New York. This was, in fact, his first exposure to the Ohio criminal justice system and the criminal justice system in general. He'd never been charged, arrested, or convicted of any crime.
And counsel, while you're at it, before you get warmed up, in thumbing through the report of the panel, it appears they really were put off by this gentleman and his remarks or his disparagement of the family, of the parents. That
Absolutely.
Seemed to really get under their skin. So now throw it back to you. Start off where you would start, but address that somewhere along the line. Did that infect the judgment of the panel here?
Well, I think, first of all, I'd like to state that the respondent's treatment of his client and his client's family was despicable. As I said, this was a young man's first exposure to the criminal justice system. He had an attorney that treated him in an inhumane fashion. There are emails in the record where the client's parents are asking just to be treated like human beings. The panel went through great lengths to describe in its report the scathing manner in which the respondent treated his clients and ultimately found that the respondent fabricated the behavior of his client and his client's family in order to try and convince the panel that he was justified in firing the clients. And that actually leads me into my first point, which is in contradiction to what Mr. Close has stated. The first of all, this is not and never was a fee dispute. This was much more than a fee dispute. This is not a situation in which an attorney completed the representation and there was a disagreement over fees. This is a situation in which an attorney was paid in full $17,726 from a family that was unsophisticated, that was very poor, that borrowed the money to take this case through trial. And the panel stated in its opinion, it's of critical importance to note that when the attorney-client relationship began, the client was adamant that he wanted a trial in this case. And that's why they hired Mr. Summers, because of his trial expertise. He didn't come close to fulfilling his own agreement. He valued this case knowing that it was going to go to trial at $15,000. Yet he quit before, as the board found, less than one-third of the pre-trial work had been completed. And he keeps $17,726? That is unconscionable. But he brings up this Kentucky fee agreement, which is nothing but a complete fabrication. If you look at the agreement, it's Exhibit 18 in materials. It's not a Kentucky fee agreement. And the board specifically found he lied about that. There are five separate references in that Kentucky, quote unquote, Kentucky fee agreement that reference the Supreme Court of Ohio, the Code of Professional Responsibilities, the IOLTA account in the state of Ohio. This was his Ohio fee agreement. He hadn't even updated it for the new code of the new rules. It had nothing to do with Kentucky. And he claimed that he went through the agreement line by line with his clients. Well, had he done that, he would have known that it was missing the language required by 1.5D3. And the reason why I bring this up is because Mr. Summers is still lying to this court today. And that's why we're at a six-month actual suspension. Yes, it's a clearly excessive fee, but we're at 6 months because the board made a finding that the respondent's testimony before the panel was laced with lies and evasiveness. This coming from a 41-year practitioner, there is simply no place in the legal profession for an attorney that is going to take advantage of a 19-year-old client and then lie about it in an effort to exculpate himself.
Were there, in fact, two expert witnesses that testified about the fee agreement?
Yes, there were two witnesses, Larry Reel and Court Gatterdam, neither of whom were ethics experts, admittedly.
Oh, but I know both of them. They're longtime practicing attorneys. Do you have to be an ethics expert to testify about whether their fee is reasonable?
Well, when you look at the record from their testimony, first of all, it was completely wrong. Court Gatterdam stated that, and this is in my brief, he stated that when you have a flat fee, the appropriate method to determine the refund amount is simply multiply hours worked by your hourly rate. That's just not the rule. That's in contradiction to 1.5. So his testimony, along with Larry Reel's testimony, who said he would have given the entire fee back, was completely irrelevant and discounted by the panel. We did not need an expert witness in this case. They offered absolutely nothing. The panel consisted of two judges and a lawyer, and they were particularly...
And they used their own judgment as to what should have been a reasonable fee in this case?
Well, what they did was they did what Mr. Summers should have done, and they went through the analysis of 1.5A, all eight factors, and they took into consideration the totality of the attorney-client relationship. And they ended up basing the clearly excessive fee finding on three critical points. The first is the respondent himself agreed to represent this Tony Bell through trial, sentencing, or other disposition.
But lawyers are always terminating cases, or clients are terminating cases, and when there is a provision in the rules that if you terminate a case, this is how you account for your time. So the fact that they said they would represent him through trial is not really material. It's how the client relationship ended and what happened at that point.
Well, there's two issues there, and I would respectfully disagree on one point. I think it is extremely relevant in this case that he did say that he would represent him through trial and withdrew early. The fee agreement made no mention of how he was going to compute the fee if he fired his clients.
No, but our rules do.
And they make you go through 1.5A factors. He did not do that. He chose one factor, hours worked times his hourly rate. And then he padded up the hours to make sure that that rate got over the flat fee amount. But what's really important for this court to consider is that it's almost unfair to consider hours, because the whole purpose of Mr. Summers forcing his client to sign this flat fee agreement was to avoid any talk of hourly rate.
And but when you say forcing them to sign, it was also to their benefit, because they were people of limited means. And I know when I initially read this, to me a six-month suspension in light of when we take people out for 6 months seems somewhat harsh. And I have to go back to an earlier question of one of my colleagues, is was it the attitude of Mr. Summers? They seem to take great issue with how he presented himself before the panel, the disparaging statements to his clients. But I do think we want to be careful in subjecting lawyers who otherwise have a fee dispute to disciplinary action.
I can respect that question, Your Honor, and here's my response to it. First of all, as I stated earlier, there was much more than a fee dispute here. But to your point specifically, the reason why we're at a six-month suspension is not because of the clearly excessive fee. If this was just a clearly excessive fee, we would not be advocating for a six-month suspension. We may be advocating for a stayed suspension. It was the lying. In my 10 years, I have not seen an opinion where the board has concluded that the respondent's testimony was laced with lies and evasiveness. That's why we're at a six-month suspension. The clearly excessive fee in and of itself warrants discipline, as does him charging a non-refundable fee. But make no mistake about it, it was the respondent's lying to the panel in an attempt to exculpate himself that brings us to an actual suspension.
Was that an actual charge?
Which one?
That was lying to the panel?
No, that kind of happened real time, but it was a huge aggravating factor. And the board, that wasn't the only aggravating factor. The board also found that he acted with a dishonest and selfish motive. He also found that the victim was vulnerable, there was no offer of restitution, and he's never acknowledged the wrongful nature of his misconduct, as evidenced by Mr. Close's argument today. And this court has stated in Cleveland Bar Association versus Judge Cleary, that they refused to stay any part of a six-month suspension based upon a board's finding that Judge Cleary, in that case, made false and deceptive statements to the panel. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And the board even concluded that the respondent approached the entire disciplinary proceeding with an attitude of righteous indignation. With respect to the clearly excessive fee, I mentioned that part of the board's findings was that the respondent himself made this agreement, agreed to take this case through trial, and then quit before the case was completed. At the time the respondent quit, there was no plea offer. No, the state had not even responded to his standard discovery request, which was nothing but a form document. Mr. Summers had attended no hearings. He and or his associate attended approximately five pretrials, and they were paid $2,726 for his work. So it's not unreasonable for him to have to refund $15,000 in light of the fact that the client, Mr. Bell, really received no value from the $15,000.
Counsel, this whole area of the fee is confusing to me. Can it be explained by he was found to have charged an excessive fee, and then we just disregard whether or not the fee he was paid was excessive or not? Because we seem to have this dichotomy. It's an excessive fee, but yet no refund. It really was not unreasonable. We don't calculate the actual time he put into it. It's kind of mush. Can you help clear this up a little bit?
Right. Well, I think to start with, Justice Kopp, the fee agreement that was entered into was for a flat fee. When he entered into the $15,000 flat fee, it was not excessive. This man was charged with a very serious crime. Mr. Summers expected the case to go to trial. He understood that this was going to take a lot of his time at trial and trial preparation. That's why he came up with a $15,000 fee. It became excessive when he fired his client without having conferred little or no benefit to his client. That's the point in time where you say you can't possibly, in good faith, take $17,726 when you completely abandon your client before you've completed pretty much any work in the case. As I stated, the state hadn't even responded to discovery. There was no plea. There were no hearings. There was no motion to suppress. Not much work was done, and that's what the board found.
But it's not appropriate to order a refund then of a portion of the fee.
Well, I think it is appropriate, and the board stated that he should refund $15,000 based upon the circumstances in which that fee was imposed.
Shouldn't the matter then go to a fee arbitration dispute resolution?
See, I don't think this should ever have gone to fee arbitration, should never go to fee arbitration, because it's not a fee dispute. And it's not fair to
put
this.
Well, if it's not a fee dispute, it seems as though the whole questioning here revolves around, as you pointed out, a $17,000 payment. But it's excessive, and yet there's experts who testify there's no refund due, it was earned.
Well, the experts didn't have
And there's all these questions that revolve around how much should the lawyer have charged, and how much is the lawyer entitled to have? And if two parties are unclear about what those numbers are, it seems as though that might be a good situation for an arbitration.
Well, Justice O'Donnell, our position on this from the beginning was not that we're going to go after the restitution in this case. Our position was, let's establish that this is a clearly excessive fee and a failure to return an unearned fee and charging a non-refundable fee. The restitution in the case followed suit. We did not make the request for the $15,000, but we absolutely support it because there was no value to the client for paying this additional $15,000. It would not be fair to drag these people into fee arbitration, make them litigate a case when they're completely unsophisticated with respect to lawyers and fees. If you look at some of the emails that they sent to Mr. Summers, they simply wanted answers like, what does this fee mean? Do we still owe you on an hourly basis? They were complete novices. And to drag them through after a lawyer took advantage of them would really not send a good message to how we treat clients and victims.
But the case wasn't tried. It was ultimately resolved by a plea to a probationable offense. And
right.
So it ended up with a satisfactory result through an assigned lawyer.
Well, satisfactory to whom? The client wasn't satisfied. He wanted an acquittal. That's why he hired Mr. Summers and paid him that amount of money. But yes, it was resolved in a non-jailable offense.
I'm somewhat troubled by your last statement that you're saying that we shouldn't send the clients to fee arbitration because they're unsophisticated. So then do we turn the disciplinary counsel into fee arbitrators? Did I misunderstand that?
No, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that it's not fair to send somebody into fee arbitration when they have no understanding of what that is, how to present their case. They can't afford a lawyer to bring to fee arbitration. They've already been taken advantage of by one lawyer. It's not fair. This court, in many cases involving excessive fees, has ordered restitution with no expert testimony. In cases cited by the respondent, Columbus Bar versus Farmer, they ordered $8,000 of a $9,000 fee returned. No expert testimony, no fee arbitration. I just don't think it's fair to make these clients suffer through another process after they're already taken advantage of and lied to by their attorney.
Well, counsel, I don't know whether we really would take that into consideration, whether they're sophisticated or whether they could stand their own in a fee arbitration, but there's a method that spelled out for the refund of fees and what's to be taken into consideration, and that's part of the Code of Professional Conduct. And clearly, that wasn't utilized here. And that's the problem that we find with his fee, and it's easy to take a look at it and say, you didn't employ what you should have. You went by an ever-changing hourly fee times the amount of hours that you are representing that you worked. And that all was unbelievable. It was not credible to the board.
Correct.
And the panel. And that's what I think is important here. It's not whether he refunds $12,500 or even the whole 15, it's his activity around this case. The dollar amount is although it's declared to be excessive, and I understand that, but I don't think that's the focus of it.
I agree 100%, Chief Justice. The panel actually stated in finding a clearly excessive fee, they listed those three factors, and one of the things they did is you have to take into the consideration the totality of the attorney-client relationship in this case. And all the facts and circumstances. And one of those facts was that he increased his hourly rate from $250 to $400 despite entering into a flat fee agreement with no notice or justification. This was all done in an attempt to justify taking the whole fee when he hadn't earned it. So the real issue is the respondent's conduct and his willingness to come before the disciplinary panel, the Board of Commissioners, and lie about what happened. So at the end of the day, we would ask that this court adopt the board's recommendation, impose a 6-month actual suspension, and order the respondent to make restitution. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Close, you've used all your time. You can have 30 seconds.
There is no question that it's all summed up in the question Justice Yvette McGee Brown asked Joe. Bill had righteous indignation because of the way the process was going down, and he thought it was unfair. He'd spent his entire life defending other people, and now he's defending himself, and he gets crossways with the disciplinary counsel, and that's all over the record before the disciplinary panel, and they reacted to his righteous indignation and anger. If this went to arbitration, and if Bill Summers was ordered to return $1,000, would you find that to be a clearly excessive fee? I think not. I'd ask you to dismiss and in the alternative reconsider the penalty that has been recommended. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.